Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today is August the 2nd, the debt ceiling deadline we've been bracing for. Yesterday evening, the House passed a plan 269 to 161. Today, it goes to the Senate. This hour, On Point, we'll look at what's been cut, what's been preserved, what's still being negotiated, and what it all means for the economy and for you. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the plan that the House passed? Did you want to see more cuts, more programs preserved? And you can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Washington is Major Garrett, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Welcome back to On Point, Major Garrett.
Hello, Jackie.
Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to play a couple of cuts from Congress yesterday. Here is Republican Congressman Mike Pence of Indiana welcoming the compromise but cautioning against taking too much credit for what he calls bipartisanship backpatting.
This day, where we see the ship of state turning ever so slightly toward that lodestar of fiscal responsibility, this day does not belong so much to any one political leader, to any one political party, or to any one branch of government. This day belongs to the American people.
Also yesterday, Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California attacked the Tea Party, claiming the budget deal was made in their image and their image alone.
What's clear is that the Tea Party is so ideologically driven to kill government that they're willing to kill the private sector, kill jobs, and kill growth in the process.
Well, let's draw a breath here, Major Garrett, and talk about what's in the deal and try to unpack it a little bit, shall we?
Drawing a breath would be welcome.
I can imagine it would be for you.
It's been a very busy couple of weeks, I must say.
What's been your biggest surprise as you look back?
Well, I write in nationaljournal.com today five truths I think that are permanent about this deal, five things that you can definitely say have emerged as permanent truths. And the biggest surprise to me is, and I think it's the most important takeaway from this entire event, for the first time in American history, a president has agreed to tie a debt ceiling increase to deficit reduction. Previously, debt ceiling increases were a grim, unhappy, but obligatory aspect of governance. The in-party, meaning the president, and if he had a like majority in the House or Senate, moved it through. No one particularly liked it. The opposition party would vote against it, but it was always sort of a tactical feint, not a real effort to drive the country even remotely close to a default situation. There had been times in 1985 and 1995 where budget disagreements required the Treasury Department to intervene and use emergency measures. That is true. But never before had there been a declaration from an opposition party in Congress that if some of their terms or most of their terms had not been met, the nation could very easily fall into default. And that's what happened this time. And mm-hmm. The president agreed. And so now, every time, for as long as our country has a debt load situation that is perceived to be economically injurious or in any way threatening our credit rating or anything else, this is going to be a part of the equation. That's an enormous precedent. It's very important. The 14th Amendment, using that to work around Congress and simply have the president use executive authority to extend the debt ceiling, if there was ever going to be invoked, it would have been now. It wasn't. I believe that has completely disappeared as a possibility for any future president. And I believe those two things are among the most important takeaways.
Hmm. What's interesting about what you say is that conceivably we could be having arguments like this one again and again.
Well, the number five permanent truth in my piece is that in the first quarter of the year 2013, whatever psychodrama the country watched play out in Washington just now will get ready to amp that up by about a factor of five, because in the first quarter of 2013, several things will happen. Of course, we'll either have a reelected President Obama or a new Republican president. We'll have a debt ceiling that will have to be raised. The year 2013 will be whenever the big discretionary cuts locked into this deal begin to take effect. So the first couple of years of this deal, the discretionary cuts, regular government operations are not going to be very large at all. They'll begin to bite really big in 2013. Plus, whatever this special committee that this debt ceiling legislation creates, it's either going to decide to raise taxes or keep some or all the Bush tax cuts. All of that will come to the fore in the first quarter of 2013. So there'll be a lot of legislative activity and a lot of changes to the economy, all set in motion by what was just decided.
I want to talk about what has just been decided, just so that everybody is at the same starting point.
Sure.
We are talking about $2 trillion plus to be cut out of the budget over the next 10 years.
Correct.
2.4
is the target.
Mm-hmm.
Now, $917 billion of that is supposed to occur in 10 years dealing with the non-entitlement section of the United States budget. That mm-hmm. is everything from environmental control to defense to FAA to roads and bridges, the fundamentals day-to-day of American government. The other $1.5 trillion is supposed to be dealt with in entitlements or tax revenue or other spending cuts. A special committee of 12 members, 6 Republicans, 6 Democrats, appointed by the leaders in Congress, come up with. They're supposed to report to Congress no later than Thanksgiving of this year. Congress is supposed to have an up or down vote, no amendments. So this has special parliamentary protection to get to the floor right away. You can't amend it. You can't change it. You can only say yes or no to it by December 23rd of this year. So I already know that the front end of my Christmas is probably already ruined.
Well, yes, that's one immediate fallout. By how much was the debt ceiling raised?
The debt ceiling will be raised by $900 billion in accordance with the discretionary cuts, the 917 that have been agreed to take place over 10 years. So that met the House Republican demand that whatever the initial increase in the debt ceiling, it would be matched dollar for dollar by spending cuts. Then the debt ceiling will be raised as soon as the special committee proposes its suggestions on deficit reduction to Congress. And if that committee fails to do so, then $1.5 trillion in spending cuts will begin to occur on what is called, and this is kind of a bizarre Washington word, sequestration. What that means is across-the-board cuts to all programs except Social Security, except Medicaid, except veterans' benefits, unemployment insurance, food stamps, and entitlement programs for the poor. All of those are exempted, completely shielded from automatic spending cuts.
Major Garrett, we can talk about some of the trigger and pressure on the trigger for the rest of this hour, and we will. But could you just we will remind us why President Obama agreed to tie the debt ceiling to this kind of deficit reduction?
Well, he said it was important to achieve two goals. Once he was under the impression that Republicans were serious about possibly pulling the lever of default. Originally, the president said, I don't want to tie this to deficit reduction. I don't believe I should. No previous president has had to. And I would like a clean increase in the debt ceiling, unencumbered by any of these other conversations. We can talk about deficit reduction, but I don't want that to be the price of raising the debt ceiling. Well, he lost that argument. And as soon as he lost that argument in mid-spring, when the House brought a bill to the floor and it died, the president said, okay, let's engage and talk. So the president decided if he was going to pay this price, why not go for a grand big deal? And that's when he began the negotiations, first through his vice president with Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, on a big deal. Then those became the direct conversations he had with Speaker Boehner. The goal was $4 trillion or more. When revenues became a complicating factor for the Speaker and for House Republicans, that deal fell away, and then it was replaced by this smaller deal that has, I would say, some of the same Washington tactics that promise deficit reduction, but on the front end, there's very little of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've gone for points 1, 2, and 5 in your Major Garrett's top 5 points coming out of this. I'm thinking we might as well go for the middle part of that.
Okay. And that's picking up on a point I just made. Washington has a tendency to promise deficit reduction later while delivering rhetoric up front. And if you look at this deal, there are $917 billion in spending cuts to regular day-to-day government operations over 10 years, but only $10 billion of that, Jackie, which is not insubstantial, but as a proportion of the 917, it's trivial. Only $10 billion are due to occur this year and next year. So that means $907 billion in discretionary spending cuts have to be pushed through in the remaining 8 years. Well, that's a lot. I've never seen it happen before, and I must tell you, I'm somewhat skeptical that it will happen, because everything about Washington's behavior before has said when you promise big deficit reduction, you take little bites up front, and then you reassess later. And this law is on the books until it's rewritten. And my gut tells me that the political pressures and the realities of cutting federal government spending that fast, at that magnitude, after 2013, are going to lead to a reassessment. And I will tell you, the Obama White House believes it will lead to a reassessment, and that reassessment, they are confident, will include a necessity to raise taxes or raise some tax revenue to offset the effect of cutting government spending this much.
So that tax increases do come into the picture. I hope you're still covering this story by then, Major Garrett.
We shall see. We shall see.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the plan to raise the debt ceiling. Joining me now from Washington is Steve Bell, Senior Director at the Economic Policy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. He served on the Senate staff of U.S. Senator Pete Domenici from New Mexico from 1974 to 1986, and then again from 1996 to 2009. And also with us from Washington, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he writes a weekly column for the Huffington Post. Welcome to On Point, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jackie.
Can we please start with a couple of clips from yesterday? Democratic Congresswoman and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California expressed reluctant acceptance of the plan.
It's hard to believe that we are putting our best foot forward with the legislation that comes before us today. I'm not happy with it, but I'm proud of some of the accomplishments in it, and that's why I am voting for it.
And Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan made an appeal to House Democrats yesterday to get the bill passed.
What this has done, it has brought our two parties together. And so I'd just like to take a second to reflect for a moment the fact that we have a bipartisan compromise here. That doesn't happen all that often around here, so I think it's worth noting. That's a good thing.
Dean Baker, let's start with you. You've been writing about this. What do you think?
Well, I have to say I've been frustrated with the whole set of events here, because here we're sitting around in the wake of the collapse of the housing bubble, 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, giving up looking for work altogether. No one's talking about that. They're talking about the budget deficit. And we all know the reason we have a very large budget deficit today is because the economy collapsed. So we have this basically, to my view, absurd story. We're yelling about the budget deficit as though that's the problem, when that was caused by the economic collapse, and completely ignoring what gave us this very large deficit. And we've had politicians of both parties. I blame President Obama as much as anyone. In his speech Monday night, he deliberately and explicitly misrepresented where the budget deficit came from, so he can blame President Bush. It came from an economic collapse. It didn't come from the war. It didn't come from the tax cuts to the rich. It didn't come from his Medicare drug program. It came from the economic collapse. But he chose to misrepresent that to score partisan points. So I frankly have been disgusted. The nation's really been disserved by this whole process.
Steve Bell, how about you? Do you think this goes some way to getting the debt under control?
No, I don't. I have to really agree with the point just made. Lots of people worked their tails off to get this passed, but all we really did was do the basic that we expect Congress to do, that is to pass the debt limit and not have the country go into default. That is as low a standard as we probably can set for a Congress. It reminds me of 1985. We heard no one in 1985 say they were going to vote against the debt ceiling increase, even if it meant default. And we were able, after a lot of scar tissue was formed, to pass Graham-Rudman-Hollings. it was ignored, as Major Garrett will remember from his days, it was ignored within about 2 years. But this is really as close to a kind of combination of theology and insanity as I have ever seen rule in the United States Congress, and I've been doing this now for 37 years.
I'd like to refer to what New York Times columnist Joe Nocera wrote this morning and ask you to comment on it, Dean. He said that we've been too focused, this is as regards unemployment, too focused on the, he calls it the numerator, our debt, and not focused enough on the denominator, growth. Could you explain what Joe Nocera, if you don't mind me asking you to explain what he wrote, means?
Yeah, the main point, you know, was saying before, the reason the deficit exploded in 2009, 2010 was the economy collapsed. If we have good growth, most of this would go away. If you look back to the late 90s, you know, there's this myth that, you know, we took the tough medicine, you know, we had tax increases, we had the budget cuts. Well, those were part of the story. But if you look at 1996, our projections for the year 2000 from 1996, that was after all the tax cuts, after all the tax increases, after all the spending cuts were already in place, the Congressional Budget Office projected we'd have a deficit in 2000 of about 2.5% of GDP. Instead, we had a surplus of close to 2.5% of GDP. That's a massive switch. But it wasn't because we raised taxes. It wasn't because we cut spending. The reason was the economy grew much better than expected. We got the unemployment rate down to 4% instead of the 6% that was projected. That's what gave us the additional revenue, reduced spending on things like unemployment benefits, food stamps, other programs. That's what moved us from the deficit to a surplus. The main focus has to be the economy, and, you know, there are going to be issues about the deficit, no doubt about it, but those are longer term, and they're relatively minor in the scheme of things. The main focus has to be getting the economy, getting the denominator to grow.
Steve Belt, you worked for a very distinguished Republican politician, Pete Domenici, and you have been looking at this a long time. When you say that this is, in your judgment, a combination of insanity and theology, could you explain what you mean? I mean, are we talking about fiscal discipline, getting our house in order, or not?
I don't think so. I think on the far right, we have a bunch of people who honestly believe, as a matter of faith or of belief, that government is inherently limiting and inherently bad and needs to be tamed and brought under control and reduced in size. Now, that's a theory. That's an article of faith that they have. And on the far left, we have as an article of faith that the government ought to be able to provide and even out the bumps of life for everyone, no matter what the cost. Those are beliefs, and I guess it's comforting for those people to have those beliefs. But to govern is to choose. It's been said many times. And we cannot have the debate dominated by either the far left or the far right. We need to have the debate dominated by some sort of balanced approach that looks at the reality we face. Sure, we have very bad economic numbers each of the last 2 weeks. No doubt about it, this economy seems to be stuttering again. And yes, we probably need tax cuts, frankly, as we propose in our plan, Dr. Rivlin and Senator Domenici, which is a year-long holiday from all payroll taxes. But after that, and as everyone from the IMF down says, the United States is on an unsustainable course with its deficits and with its mounting debt. That underlying structural imbalance was not addressed at all in this deal.
Where does this leave entitlements? Are they protected, or will commission of 12 have something to say about that?
Well, the commission of 12 can deal with entitlements. The program, the $900 billion in cuts, doesn't touch entitlements. The sequestration, if the commission doesn't come to an agreement and there is no deal, entitlements are largely protected. There's a little clause about Medicare and providers. We could skip that for the moment, but entitlements would largely be protected from the sequestration. But it's certainly possible that the Commission of 12 would come up with a proposal that would go after Medicare and Social Security, Medicaid. Those are all in principle on the table. Now, again, they'll face the same political opposition as is out there today. So my guess is they probably will not choose to go after those programs, but it certainly is a possibility.
And just to reestablish this Commission of 12 or Gang of 12, or some people are already calling it the Dirty Dozen, the leaders of Congress and the Senate each get to choose three people, three politicians, three lawmakers to be on this commission. Do you have confidence in that, Steve Bell?
No, I don't. Setting up a committee to do what two or three commissions have already recommended seems to me a little bit of waste of time, frankly. I don't know anyone who's serious that doesn't know what the problem is in the short and long run. We've had lots of reports from many different groups, lots of recommendations and lots of acknowledgments of what the long-term debt problem is and that it's unsustainable. I guess they needed to put this together with the threat of the sequestration in order to get the bill to get the debt ceiling increased. But again, that's a very low standard. One good thing I think has come out of this that was absolutely necessary, and that is to broaden the debate. When I go around, I'm from the center part of the country, so when I go around and talk to my friends, they think that 25% of government spending goes to foreign aid. I think we've gone some way towards educating the American people on where the money goes now and where it's going to go in the future, and that it isn't foreign aid.
Let's take a couple of calls. Jerry is calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Welcome to On Point, Jerry.
Hi, Jackie. I kind of agree a little bit here that this really, I mean, in the long run, $2.4 trillion over 10 years, and they're estimating, you know, our budgets will, you know, in that period will have been at least $45 trillion, and a $2.4 trillion cut out of that, I don't even think they'll even cut that much in a 10-year period. And it's just amazing that the rhetoric that's been going on, using the analogy of holding a gun to the head of the American people, calling members in the Tea Party in the Congress, calling them terrorists and jihadists. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, members of the Democratic Party saying this and the president saying that.
Would you have been in favor of tax increases as a part of this package, Jerry?
Well, I mean, you could take every penny away from the so-called rich people, and it still wouldn't cover it. They always talk about, you know, soaking the rich, but it's always the middle class who get wet.
All right, and that's who you think is getting wet this time.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much for that point. Steve Bell, would you have been in favor of tax increases as a part of what we have just seen, this agreement?
The answer is yes. If you mean by tax increases, getting rid of certain loopholes in the tax code, the recommendation we have is pretty straightforward. Our recommendations were, as I said, the tax holiday from Social Security and FICA taxes for a year, followed by a complete restructuring of the tax code, which we go into in some detail. There are promises that may happen, but I know already that billions of dollars are being spent on lobbyists down here to make sure that these loopholes stay open. So, yes, we could have done something reasonably good about closing certain tax expenditures. And in the long run, we have a tax code that inhibits growth. If we want growth, we're going to have to simplify the tax code and take some of the special interest provisions out of that tax code.
Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where will some of these discretionary cuts hit, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, a lot's up in the air. Let me just comment briefly. We did have very good growth in the 90s with a higher tax rate. That wasn't that long ago. We should remember that. So obviously, there couldn't be that much of an impediment to growth. But in terms of discretionary, we're focusing on domestic discretionary for a large share, perhaps the bulk of the cuts. And even though the caller is exactly right, we're talking about 5% of the total spending. But when we wall off Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, very important, very popular programs, and largely protect many other programs, we might be talking about taking 20, 25, 30% of domestic discretionary. This is everything we spend on transportation, most of what we spend on education, most of what we spend on research and development. These are areas that are very important for future growth, and that's the area that seems targeted to get the biggest portion of the cuts. So although it's not that large a share of the whole budget, that is a very large share of the domestic discretionary budget.
How does this trickle down to the states?
Well,
we're probably going to see cutbacks in a lot of these payments do go to state and local governments. Obviously, state and local governments are already stressed. Just about all of them have deficits, and most of them work with balanced budget requirements. So they've had to make serious cutbacks and or raise taxes. And we're going to see further cutbacks. We're almost certain to see further cutbacks in a lot of the transfers from the federal government to state and local governments. So they're going to feel this.
Mm-hmm. Steve Bell, what do you have to say? Do you think that where do you think discretionary cuts are going to hit?
Oh, I think they're obviously in the annual appropriated accounts, which defense and non-defense make up about a third or less of the budget. So we are taking almost all of the cuts out of areas that are not the problem. It's important to remember discretionary appropriated accounts, things that we actually pass every year, are not the problem. The problem is we have made promises we cannot keep in Medicare, Medicaid, pensions. And over the next 5, 10, 15 years, just like some European countries now are facing the reality they've made promises that they cannot keep, we're going to have to start getting serious about fundamental reform of entitlements. And I don't want to hide behind that word entitlements. It means Medicare, Medicaid, the two things which more than any other single factor are driving the unsustainability of this budget. More old people. There was an old statement, demographics is destiny. And the demographics plus the increase in health care costs is really a kind of compounding interest in the wrong way for the American people.
Dean?
I agree completely on the Medicare, Medicaid point, but I think the issue here is that it's our U.S. health care system. We pay more than twice as much per person for our health care as the average across other wealthy countries, Germany, France, Canada, whoever you want to put into that mix. And we don't have anything obvious to show for it in terms of better care. What we have to do is fix our health care system, and that's our private health care system. We don't have a separate system that serves the government and one that serves the private sector. Our private health care system's broken, and we could do whatever we want. We could cut Medicare and Medicaid, but if we don't fix our private health care system, that's just going to mean that people can't get care. So we have to get our costs in line, but that's a private sector problem, not the government program problem.
What about military spending? There has been it's been put forward that military spending will be cut, especially if the two parties can't come to agreement about what to cut.
Well, I think that's very likely. I think that is going to be more important than most people admit as this group of 12 gets together. You already see both among Republicans and some Democrats in Congress a sort of semi-buyer's remorse where they're saying, you know, this might be a little tough on defense, whether you saw Senator Lieberman this morning on television or whether you heard people on the radio last night. You're beginning to see people say, wait a minute, we're fighting 2.5 wars. We have 300,000 men and women in various capacities overseas, and we're talking about perhaps as much as 8% to 10% cuts in national defense. So I think that is going to be a big stumbling block.
Dean Baker?
I was saying there's a huge expansion in the military budget in the wake of September 11th, of course, and we're still pretty much at the high levels of expenditure at the peak of those wars. So I think under any circumstances, spending would come down over the next decade. The question is how much, how fast.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the debt deal today and what it will mean for the economy and for you. And we're talking with Steve Bell, Senior Director at the Economic Policy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. He served twice on the Senate staff of U.S. Senator Pete Domenici, Republican of New Mexico, and with Dean Baker, Co-Director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he writes a weekly column for the Huffington Post. And, of course, we're taking your calls. Let's take one now from Chris, calling from Rochester, New York. Welcome to On Point, Chris.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. As a staunch Democrat, I can safely say that I am ashamed of my party for what they have done with this debt ceiling deal. They've came to the ideologues of the right wing, and really this compromise has been a sham. They say it's bipartisan, they say it's a compromise, but really we got nothing. We had to give up so much in our spending cuts. And if you look around this country, we have bridges that are literally falling down. We've got schools who can't afford paper. We've got people out of work. I don't think we can afford more spending cuts. And really what we needed to have done was to push for the revenue increases that would have made programs like Medicare and Medicaid sustainable.
The real place that these cuts are really, I think, going to be felt, as I understand it, is in 2013. Dean Bell, do you agree with that? Are you worried about that? Dean Baker, I'm really, sorry. Forgive me.
That's okay.
And Dean, we have Steve ahead. Bell. That's fine.
Okay. Well, I am worried about it. I mean, I think the most charitable thing you could say is that you could see this all as a cynical deal, that you write down a lot of cuts on paper, and Major Garrett, if you caught him at the beginning, is saying, well, you know, they may never take place. So you start to see cuts in 2013 in principle. If President Obama gets reelected, if he gets, you know, picks up some seats, I don't know if there's a likelihood he'll win back the House, but if they pick up some seats, well, he's in a position to raise taxes, you know, let the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy expire. They could ignore a lot of this. I mean, one of the, you know, to my mind, sort of silly things you could say, whether it's good or bad, you really cannot bind future Congresses. We have a democracy, and there's nothing to say that, you know, the Congress that we elect in 2010 is wiser, better than the Congress we're going to elect in 2012, 14, 16, whenever. So they can write down on paper, we're going to have these really big cuts over the next decade. But if in 2012, 2014, 2016, people don't think that's a good idea, they're going to elect people to Congress, and they aren't going to go along with those cuts. So, you know, what to my mind was important here, and I don't doubt Steve will disagree on me, is that they did not go after Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, because those are programs where you have schedules written into law. Once you cut those benefits, it's very hard to restore them.
But, Steve, you were saying that you do think that entitlements are going to have to be trimmed.
Yeah, it's kind of a matter of simple arithmetic. Let's take the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office baseline. They assume that Medicare and Medicaid cost will increase by the rate of increase in our gross domestic product, our GDP, plus approximately 1.7% over that every year for the next 10 years. So we not only have more people, about 12,000 now a day, new net Medicare recipients, for example, but each one of the procedures those people receive will cost more in the future, and they will go up by more than the rate of growth of the economy, if you believe CBO's forecast. There is no way you can get anywhere close to retaining the solvency of this country if you don't fundamentally reform those programs, starting now, very slowly, and phasing in the cuts, the changes, whether you want to increase the retirement age or whether you want to increase the Medicare age. Those are things people will fight about. But fundamental change is not part of the package that was passed. All the hard choices were avoided. And to get to the point that Dean and Major made, it's exactly what's happened in each of the last three decades. Congress passed something that was going to really restrain spending and bring deficits under control. And when it got too tough, Congress said legislatively, well, never mind, because one Congress cannot bind a following Congress.
So what specifically, Steve Bell, would you cut? What would you raise retirement age? What painful threshold would you be willing to cross?
The first one, and I think this is the one that Dr. Rivlin worked so hard on.
Alice Rivlin from
Brookings, and she was the co-chair along with Pete Domenici of our task force. Mm-hmm. It's called premium support for Medicare. It was tried in a rather mandatory fashion by Paul Ryan in the budget the House passed, and that is not what we endorse. We endorse a form of premium support that gives a voluntary out to people who wish to take a certain sum of money, let me say $10,000 just for the sake of this discussion. And we would say you take GDP growth plus 1% and you increase that voucher or premium support payment to people year by year by year, starting in about 12 years from now. That gives everyone a chance to plan for their retirement and for their medical care in retirement. And while it is somewhat controversial, it is one way to try to bring some discipline into what is now a very chaotic medical delivery system.
Where would people invest that money if indeed they were able to have an independent investment as they saved for these health care costs?
No, it wouldn't work that way. You would actually give a Medicare recipient the following choice. Do you wish to use the $10,000 to stay in the present Medicare system, or do you wish to use the $10,000 to go out in the private market and see if you can find a better deal for your particular circumstance? Now, a guy who's been running triathlons all of his life, or competing in triathlons all his life, is probably going to be in somewhat better shape than someone who has been sedentary all his life. And that person may decide, I don't need quite as much coverage. I think I can get a better deal in the private market. The more sedentary person may say, no, I don't want to take a chance. I'm staying in Medicare. That's the kind of choice we think brings some discipline to the medical provision system in this country.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Benjamin. He's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Benjamin.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question, and I'm not being facetious. It's a real question I don't understand. And that's not about the wings. We do have left wing and the right wing still can't fly. So here's the question. I'm looking on the internet on the history of U.S. deficits. 3 years ago, the deficit was, according to what I see, about $500 billion a year. Right? It's about, let's say it's half of what it is now. So the question is, A, what happens in the last 3 years that makes us to spend twice more? To have a deficit twice bigger. And the second, could we just go back to 3 years ago, take that budget, delete everything else we didn't spend 3 years ago, and I don't think we even had a budget for the last 3 years, and spend only that deficit $800 billion a year. That means it would save us $8 trillion in the next 10 years.
Okay.
Why can't we do that? What happens in the last...
Thank you, Benjamin. Well, why can't we just turn back the clock, Dean Baker?
Great question. We had a huge housing bubble that was supporting the economy, and unfortunately, we had a lot of people running around yelling about budget deficits when they actually were not very large, and they would not talk about the housing bubble either because they didn't see it or didn't think it really mattered. That housing bubble burst and gave us the worst downturn since the Great Depression. That's why the budget deficit has exploded. So we actually had relatively small budget deficits. 1.4% of GDP was the projection for 2008 2009 before the housing bubble collapsed. And that's the reason the deficit went through the roof. So it'd be great if we go back to 4.5% unemployment, but unfortunately, we don't seem to be about to do that. I just want to get back very quickly to the point Major Garrett made. I'm very good at arithmetic, too. That's exactly right. The projections do show that health care costs are going to make Medicare and Medicaid unaffordable. But again, I think the point is to fix our health care system. We pay more than twice as much for prescription drugs as people do elsewhere in the world. We pay our doctors more than twice as much. Our auto workers don't get more than twice as much, but our doctors do. We pay huge insurance bills. The Congressional Budget Office projected that if we went the route of the Ryan plan, I understand Steve's advocating something somewhat different, but if we went the route of the Ryan plan, that would add $34 trillion to the cost of providing Medicare equivalent policies over its 75-year planning period. Medicare is actually much more efficient than the private sector. We have a lot of research that shows that it's not less efficient. Going that route is almost certainly going to mean worse care and higher costs.
I really would like to talk a little bit about unemployment in this program. It's at 9.2%, and second quarter GDP growth was underwhelming, to say the least, at 1.3% annual rate. Manufacturing has just hit its lowest level in 2 years in July. Now we are talking about $2.4 trillion in cuts. I mean, how much do you think, Steve Bell, this could shave from GDP growth?
Well, 2.4 over 10 years, I don't want to use the word that Major used, which was kind of trivial. That is the $10 billion in the first year, though it's probably a good word. The best work I've seen by macroeconomic analysis is basically it'll probably be not felt much by the real economy. But let's talk more broadly.
Even if you don't have a job?
Oh, if you don't have a job... That brings me to this point. When Mary and Joe are talking over the coffee table in the morning, they are not talking about America losing its AAA rating. They're talking about losing their job or losing their home, or if they're unfortunate enough to have people fighting overseas, losing someone they care about. Now, that's the reality for the majority of Americans in this country. So until we do have growth, and until we are able to come upon some combination that frees up the private enterprise system in this country and lets, to be blunt about it, the vital spirits, the animal spirits flow again, we aren't going to be able to get out of that. We're not stupid at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We know it's a three-legged stool.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have growth, you have to have restraint in spending, and you have to have a better and more revenues.
The states most affected by this are Maryland, Virginia, South Carolina, Tennessee, and New Mexico because of their dependence on federal spending. If one is unemployed in any of those places, or really anywhere in America, Dean Baker, do you look to this deal with anything like confidence?
No, I mean, this is no doubt a negative. I mean, we could argue as to how big a negative it is, but if we're talking about cutting back spending, you know, it's funny, the Republicans were running around saying that, you know, you raise taxes, that's going to hurt the economy. Well, spending is money in the economy, too. It's the exact same story. So you're pulling money out of the economy at a time when we desperately need it. So this is going in the wrong direction, and Steve's right. Ideally, you know, most of this will take place later, so the immediate impact in 2011, 2012 hopefully won't be that large. But even if we're just talking about slowing growth by 1 or 2 tenths of a percentage point GDP, which are the numbers I've seen, we're still talking about 200,000 or 300,000 jobs, which, you know, for those people, it's not trivial. And, you know, again, it's going the wrong way. We should be talking about ways to boost growth. And unfortunately, this I can only see as being a negative.
Let's take another call. Janet is calling from Montreal. However, she wants us to know she's on the highway. So let's see how it goes. Welcome to On Point, Janet.
Thank you.
And your point is?
Well, I'm calling because I've been carefully paying attention to what's been happening in the U.S. And a lot of things have gone through my mind. One of the things is that I feel that, you know, looking at the bigger picture, I feel that, you know, your democracy needs to be better educated and you know, your media needs to be sort of put to better use so people can better decide things. That's one thing, because I find that in general the media is, you know, very shallow and just kind of often bent towards entertainment.
All right. Also, well, thank you, Janet. We are definitely trying to do our best here. What about the point that a moment ago, Dean Baker, Steve Bell said, we really need to unleash the creative forces to do more on jobs creation. Is the financial climate we're in at the moment likely to do that? Hasn't that been tried?
Yeah, you know, if you look carefully at what's missing in demand, it's really on the foreign side. It's really net exports, because investment's actually fairly good. If you look at investment in equipment and software, that's held up fairly well. We've seen a huge fall off in investment in structures, but that's simply because we had a housing bubble and a bubble in non-residential construction, and we've had huge overbuilding. So it's not that people don't lack the animal spirits. They see that there's huge overbuilding in most sectors. So what we really need to spur demand is an increase in net exports, and you get that by decline in the dollar. And unfortunately for politicians, it's very hard for them to say, we want a lower dollar, because they think it's not macho or something. But that is how you increase net exports. I don't know of any other way. We could wave the magic wand and talk about this trade agreement, that trade agreement, but that's really nonsense. Far and away, the most important determinant of our trade balance is the value of the dollar, and it's way too high right now.
Steve, one thing that perhaps Janet's comment makes me think about is, how do we look right now to other countries, would you say, in terms of dealing with the issues most of concern to Americans? And is it important? Does it really matter?
Oh, I think it matters a great deal. I don't want to sound like Neil Ferguson or saying this is the beginning of the end of the Empire of America as it was for Rome, but we have to be conscious of the fact that I believe this entire event in Washington, D.C. has created a little bit of apprehension in our partners overseas and in our, especially in people who hold our debt. I think it's fair for people to wonder why, for the first time in literally decades, a substantial wing of a serious party, the Republican Party, said, well, let's just let the debt default. As I heard one senator say, well, you know, the short-term pain will be offset by long-term gain. And I thought to myself, well, for people like me from New Mexico, that short-term pain may be what all we suffer for the next 20 or 30 years. And the long-term gain, if it ever comes, is kind of theoretical. The fact of the matter is, I think they're baffled by our behavior.
All right. Just very, very quickly, Dean.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds very strange to people. I mean, people understand the appropriations process, spending money, taxing, but the idea that we're not going to pay our bills, that's very strange, and that you'd have serious people, ostensibly serious people, saying we aren't going to pay bills that we've already incurred. You know, you argue over it at the time you spend it, not, you know, when it's time to pay the bill.
Well, That's it. We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thanks for having me, sir.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, and Steve Bell is senior director at the Economic Policy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.